Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there's a lot of movement going on out in the outdoors these days when it comes to the bird world especially. So we'll talk a little bit about that with our guest today, Jamie Nack, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist, David Drake, Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison and a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. So they have some news from the birding world as well as some great reasons to get outdoors this fall. What outside events are you looking forward to? Love to hear about those. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as well about wildlife. Maybe you've got a photo you want to have of a bird or something you want to have identified. You can go to our Facebook page for that. You can also email us questions at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post, or you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Jamie Nack, nice to have you back.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And David Drake, good to see you again.
Thank you, Larry. Likewise.
Well, I tell you what, birders always get excited when they hear about a rare bird sighting, and you have some information on a rare one that's been spotted?
Yeah, a couple, actually. One is the magnificent frigate bird, also called sometimes the man-o'-war bird. And what's unusual about this bird is it's found typically down in tropical waters, so down both sides of the area of Central America, you know, down through Florida, coast of Florida there, into northern South America and things like that. So I'm sure if you've been down to Florida, Texas, you know, along the coast, that I'm sure you've seen this bird. You just may not be aware that you've seen it. So it's a little unusual it's up here. It's not the first sighting that's been up in the upper Midwest or even, you know, beyond north of the tropics. But what is really unusual about it is the tropic birds typically spend most of their life flying over water, rarely landing on water. So they really are a tropical water bird. And for them to be this far north and this far landlocked is what makes this a little unusual.
You wonder if it isn't a hurricane induced.
Yeah, it could be. And a lot of times when you have what's called accidentals or rarities like this, that they get blown off course, or, you know, with a storm comes and, sure, and they get blown further west or east or north, south, whatever the case is. But this bird is really interesting. It's got, you know, it's an awesome flyer, very strong flyer. It's got a forked tail, kind of, you know, long, somewhat narrow wings, like that.
Color? But
kind of a blackish, whitish bird. But the really interesting thing about it is the male, during breeding season, his adornment, he has a bright red throat that he will inflate, very similar to the prairie chickens that we have up here in the central part of Wisconsin. And
actually, if you go to our Facebook page, we've got a nice photo up of one,
yeah,
of a male in all its regalia.
Yep. Yeah, they are really, really neat birds. So that's fun. And you notice them because of that long forked tail as well. Then the other bird that was up here is a Say's phoebe. And so we have phoebes. Phoebes are in the flycatcher family. We have an eastern phoebe that's native to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Say's phoebes, and we've got a whole host of other phoebes in the United States, but here in Wisconsin, the eastern phoebe is the primary one. Say's phoebes is primarily found mostly in the western half of the United States. They're kind of a open, kind of desert, prairie, shrubland type bird. A little bit smaller than a robin, kind of a palish gray. They've got a kind of a cinnamon chest, belly, things like that. And again, it's not unusual they're here. We've had them here before, and as a matter of fact, they've been seen as far east as Nova Scotia. So that's well out of their range. But it's pretty neat to see them as well. So
absolutely,
those are the two birds that have gotten the birders so excited here. And we've got roughly 400 bird species in the state of Wisconsin. It's always fun to see a new bird, but usually when you have these rarities like this, you know, birders will flock not only from throughout the state, but other parts of the United States just to see it, because it is such an unusual thing to see so far out of its range.
Speaking of birds, Christy in Chippewa Falls has a question about one. Let's go there. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We've been hearing, and we're really excited to hear, we think our long-eared owls calling before sunrise, maybe a male and female, two different pitches. And we're curious if this might be a seasonal change in what's prompting it, and we are calling from inside the city limits, so we're excited about that.
Christy, thanks so much for the call. We have a whole host of owl species in the state of Wisconsin that are here year-round, more or less, from screech owls to barred owls to great horned owls, short and long-eared owls, things like that. And I'm wondering, based on the fact that you're in the city, I'm wondering if it's not a great horned owl versus a long-eared owl. And both of them can look somewhat similar because they have those tufts of hair that stick up or tufts of feathers that stick up on each side of their head. But long-eared owls are typically more of a prairie species, and you really would not see them very regularly in the city. But you would see great horned owls in cities
all the time.
And great horned owls are one of the first bird species that start breeding in our state. And, by the end of January, usually, they're starting to hatch out chicks. So they are starting to set up territory now and start to call. And the way they call for mates and set up territory is by calling. And so a great horned owl is really typically what you'd hear as an owl, hoot, 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 hoot. So I'm wondering if it's not a great horned owl versus a long-eared owl. But go either if you have a bird book or go to your internet and just search an image for great horned owl and long-eared owl and see if it isn't the great horned owl.
Or even the sound.
Yeah. So the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has a section on their website all about birds. And if you typed in great horned owl right there, it'd give you pictures, information to identify it, and then you could listen to the audio. We have been treated to a great horned owl the last couple of early mornings, evenings as well. So I don't know if they're young, maybe starting to separate from the adults, and they're kind of begging and calling back and forth. So, fun to hear for sure.
Fun to hear.
But we do definitely have long-eared owls in the state, and they're relatively common, but it would be unlikely for them to be in the city.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right,
thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I should have asked her if she lives near the Arboretum. That would be an area, if you were going to see a long-eared owl, in Madison, it would most likely be in the Arboretum.
Yeah, out in the prairie, for sure.
Out in the prairie. Christine in Glenwood City has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christine.
Hi there. I've got two things. First, this is an exciting time of year. I had about 100 killdeer traveling together in my pasture, so that was fun to see when birds are flocking.
Cool.
And then my other question is, I live in western Wisconsin near the Twin Cities, and caring for our fine feathered fronds is very important to me. So I want to be sure that there are no more hummingbirds passing through, because I was going to take down those feeders. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, good question, and I'm glad you asked it. I would definitely keep your feeders up, especially in southern Wisconsin, for a couple of more weeks. So reports are hummingbirds have moved south from the northern part of Wisconsin, but there's still birds being seen in the southern part. And you may always have
central and southern.
Yep. And you may always have later migrants as well. So while I'm in Columbia County and have feeders up, I have not seen a hummingbird recently, but I'm still replacing that nectar and putting it up. So I would definitely wait a couple more weeks.
Okie doke, I will do. Thanks a bunch for your help.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. If you have a question or a comment, maybe a sighting you want to talk about, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. She mentioned, our last caller mentioned migrating birds, and there are quite a few migrating birds right now.
Yeah, we're starting to see some of the short-distance migrants. So in the last couple of days, really seeing more robins. She mentioned the killdeer, and then some of the blackbird species, kinglets, and certainly there's been more geese in the air, mm-hmm. if you've noticed that, if you're commuting in and out from work. Sandhill cranes in the central part are definitely staging. I would guess there'd be events over by Baraboo to watch them on the Wisconsin River as they stage. So, it is just an absolutely beautiful time of year.
Yeah, some warblers are starting to move. Mm-hmm. So that's and warblers this time of the year are always hard to identify because they've gone to their fall plumage colors. So there's always arguments amongst birders. What bird is that versus that? And it only intensifies during the fall when you're trying to identify fall warblers. But the other thing is that you're starting to see raptors, hawks moving.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
So broadwing hawks are starting to come through here. And usually by the end of September, the broadwings are through our state and moving south. But I just looked up before we came here this morning, Hawk Ridge, which is a observation point for raptor migration in Duluth, which overlooks Lake Superior. And so their record in one day, I think back in 2003, they had over 100,000 broadwing hawks fly over
Isn't
their point
amazing?
In one single day. Yeah, it's incredible.
Absolutely amazing.
We've had students through the department through the years that have worked there, been seasonal employees, and done that counting and helped with those estimates.
Yeah, if you've never gone up to Hawk Ridge and seen the migration of raptors, because you see eagles, hawks, merlins, kestrels, owls, and just the mass numbers of them is just ridiculously impressive.
Doug in Tribor has a question for you. Hi there, Doug. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, we've been hearing a bird at nighttime. We've never heard it before. We've been here about 30 years. And some of our neighbors, they actually got people out of their houses when the windows were open. And it started pretty much when it got dark, and it could go off and on until it would get light. We know it's not an owl.
What does it sound like?
Okay, this is going to be embarrassing.
That's why we asked.
Just like that. It'll do it one time.
Like that?
And then, excuse me?
Like that?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll do it one time, and then there'll be an answer from another. And then in about a minute or two later, they'll do it again. Just one of those caw or pterodactyl sound, whatever, and then there'll be an answer. And it could be 9 at night. It could be 1 in the morning. It could be 3 in the morning. I was looking on the computer, and the only thing we could come up with was a black-capped heron or something like that. We're by swamp. We're by a lake.
Yeah.
A willow swamp, cattail swamp, channels with branches hanging over the water. But our yard, our neighborhood here, we're about 2 blocks from all that swampy kind of stuff, and we're like in an oak hickory woods, which I didn't know why the heron would be out at night in an oak hickory woods when I would think that night black heron, whatever, that's all we could come up with.
Well, there are black and yellow-capped night herons in the state, and I don't know if you've listened to that song. That's one possibility. The other thing, when you say that it sounds like it calls and then somebody returns the call, that is more indicative of animals trying to find themselves during maybe a mating season or something like that. And and again, we've already talked a little bit about owls, but it could be a possibility that's an owl.
Are there owls that make noises? And this was, we haven't heard it for a couple of weeks, but we heard it in like September and August for about a 4 or 6 week period.
Yep. Yeah. So maybe go and go online and or to the All About Birds website that Jamie referenced earlier. Because they've got some great audio there about bird songs, but call up and look up screech owl, and maybe look up one of the night heron species.
We did the night heron one, and it kind of sounded like that, but they kept on, maybe just because there was a recording, but it was multiple.
The other one is to think about maybe a king rail. And so listen to some of the rail species.
Yeah, that's
rail.
A good one.
Yeah, especially because you mentioned you're around marshy areas. And so, rails would be in there, and they might be calling right now as well.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Thanks, Doug. Appreciate the call. Well, Carlene in Brooklyn wonders about something. Let's go there. Hi, Carlene.
Hi there. I am a little frustrated. I had a lot of English sparrows, so I went to Wild Birds Unlimited and asked them what to do. So I have fishing line tied on my feeders and only safflower seeds in them. But now I'm not getting any birds, and I wonder if it's the time of year or if there's something I could add back in there that would attract more birds, but not the English sparrows.
Well, thanks for the question, Carlene. It is a little early to be having a lot of activity at the feeders, and that's partly because we have a lot of natural foods on the landscape yet at this time of year. So I have just started to put out some black oil sunflower and not really getting much at the feeders myself. If you wait a couple of weeks as we get colder temperatures and there's less available on the landscape, it's been more picked over, then you'll start to see those feeder birds pick up. But the other thing to keep in mind is that of the 400 species we have in the state, very few actually visit feeders. So your opportunity for diversity is somewhat limited because not all birds will come to feeders for forage. So what I would think about in the next month or so as you start to put out feeders is thinking about diversity of food that you're supplying and feeder styles. So, for instance, putting out a suet feeder putting out a thistle tube feeder, and then putting out either the safflower you'd mentioned or black oil sunflower. So the advice that you got, I think safflower and black oiled sunflower are the single best seeds you could be providing. It pays to spend a little additional money to get that 100% seed rather than those commercial mixes that are less expensive, but then there's a lot of fillers in there that attract some of those house sparrows and some of the the more undesirable species. So if you switch to a high quality seed like safflower and black oil sunflower in the next month or so, as it starts to cool off, I think you'll see those birds start to come. But we're also kind of just not quite there for the timing.
I think the prices are down now quite a bit lower than what they were, 2 years ago or even a year
ago?
Yeah,
if you do some looking and even, online looking and comparing prices and order in bulk, of course, you can find some good deals on that stuff. But it's well worth it. You just have less spillage and mess to clean up as well.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I do have safflower now. I wonder about peanuts as well. Is that recommended?
Yeah, I've fed in a peanut feeder, shelled peanuts, mm-hmm. or you could put out right. a handful of peanuts still in the shell and you'll get the jays to come in and take them. So that's the key, some diversity of feeder styles and diversity of food out there, but just in high quality.
Jays love
great.
Those peanuts.
Mm-hmm. It's fun to watch them.
Yeah, it's fun to watch them. Thanks, Carlene.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's go to Jim in South Milwaukee then. Jim, hi.
Yes, hello. About 3 months ago, we rode the car ferry out of Manitowoc. And I think there were as many pelicans as there were seagulls. And we've never seen that up here before. Where have they come from?
Well, Jim, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say pelicans came from an egg.
Well, beyond that.
But aside from that.
So, the pelicans you're seeing are white pelicans, and they have made a bit of a comeback in the last, 10 or 15 years, something like that. They're a native species to Wisconsin. They were kind of decimated for a while, and then they've started to come back now. They're growing in population, and as they do that, they migrate north and south. And as they come up here for the summer, they're feeding on the fish stocks on the Great Lakes a lot of times, or you'll find them on some larger lakes and things like that. So
the Mississippi River.
Mississippi River, yeah. So they're native species, and they're just starting to make a bit of a comeback from when they were decimated as a local population, at least, or a statewide population from maybe 10, 20 years ago.
That's absolutely amazing. They were feeding on the fish that were stunned by the propellers on the car ferry.
Yeah, they're neat birds, and they're fun to watch. I mean, you talk about groups of birds or groups of animals, so, a murder of crows, for example, or a flock of flock of geese. But pelicans are called a squadron, and the way they fly, they really do look like a squadron. It's kind of fun to watch them dive into the water and things like that. They're a pretty entertaining bird.
Yeah. The one thing I did learn down in Florida is that if you are on a boat and one is sitting on a piling, you don't want to go too close because they will take off and unload.
Yeah.
You learned that the hard way, Jim.
That's right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Jamie Nack and David Drake from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 1 o'clock today on 1A, survivors of mass shootings carry heavy burdens long after the bullet wounds heal, and we'll talk about remembering the injured today at 1 on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're taking a look at the world of wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening in. One open line at 1-800-642-1234. Got a photo. You can put it up on our Facebook page or questions. You can also send them via email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Daniel in Toma next. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for calling.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I drive semis, and I was coming down from Babcock, Wisconsin, on 173.
Yeah.
And it was just before sunset, and a bird came off a tree, and I don't know what it was, but the wingspan was as wide as my semi. And I had to slam on the brakes to avoid it because it was coming. I don't know if it was going after something or whatever. What kind of bird is that big? I thought we got rid of those in the dinosaur days.
Did it have a So it had a wide wingspan. What about its legs? Were they long?
Like, no, they were medium, not very long. But it came down. I mean, trust me, I was trying to avoid the bird more than anything. And then I just never seen anything like it. It was big.
But it did come down. It was perched in the tree?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then that natural reserve there. You got to remember that's the natural, or is that Nacida Natural
yep.
Park is.
Yeah.
So what kind of bird is that big? Is that an owl? It couldn't be an eagle.
It's probably not an owl. It could be an eagle. It could be
an eagle.
Well, bald eagle would be the most likely, although we do have goldens occasionally more on the western part of the state. But even though it could be a bald eagle, the immatures, the young eagles, don't get their white head until they're about 4 years old. So it could have been an immature bald eagle. As you mentioned, you're near Nacida. I mean, theoretically, it could have been a heron that was perched in the tree, but typically they're not in trees unless they're in their rookery, the area they use for nesting, and you'll see nests right. and other species. I'm sure if you drive truck that you've seen numerous red-tailed hawks. They're always along the sides of the road, looking, hunting from their perch. I don't know. My hunch is a bald eagle is probably the most likely.
I mean, if you're talking about a large wingspan, what came to mind, I think those are the questions you were leading toward, Larry, is a sandhill crane, but they don't typically perch in trees.
No. And
the only other thing is a turkey vulture, maybe. But was it black? Do you what color of the bird was it?
It was more darker. That's what I was thinking. It was more dark. Like I said, it came down so fast. And it was, like, not black, but it had, like, brown and black.
Did you notice if it had a head that looked more like a turkey?
I would say, yeah. I would say more like a turkey.
Well, I'm wondering if it wasn't a turkey vulture. And those are pretty large birds, in the order of a grown eagle. And they've got a pretty decent wingspan as well. So
Like I said, it scared me because I just tried to avoid it because I don't like to hit any animal. I'm an animal lover.
Yeah.
But something like that, if it would have hit my windshield, I don't think he would have survived, and I don't think my windshield would have survived.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you get a chance to look at a bird book or online, look at some of the birds Jamie mentioned, or also maybe look at a turkey vulture.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Daniel. Cheryl in Conover has something for us. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
The gentleman that spoke about the night noises.
Yeah.
Well, we live up in Vilas County, and we hear that a lot. And we have come to the conclusion that it is turkeys, because we have turkeys everywhere up here, and they perch in the trees at night. And I think they're having a conversation to each other.
they're talking about you.
They do that, and it's a quick ha like that. It's real quick, and I'm thinking, it's got to be the turkeys. It just has to be.
Well.
So I'm thinking maybe that guy's got turkeys in his tree.
It's possible. I still, my hunch is thinking owl, just based on time of year. And
Yeah,
and the turkeys, typically you're going to hear, either a hen that's putting. You're going to hear some soft clucks or purrs. I've been out in the field when I've heard turkeys gobbling when it was still dark. Those are pretty recognizable to me and not really more like cat-like or screechy-like. So,
yeah,
but
this is screech. This is screech, definitely.
Yeah.
In fact, it woke me up. They do this right by my house all night long. So,
yeah.
And you see them.
No, I don't see them. That's the problem, because we don't have city lights here, so it's like it's dark.
Yeah.
Well, I would encourage listeners to, again, go to that All About Birds website and listen to some of the vocal recordings of these species and know that they make different calls depending on the time of the year, and they'll have some options to listen to different sequences and so on. But I would go ahead and listen to both turkeys and some of the different owl species, especially great horned owl and screech owl.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, and I thought at one point, we have a coyote up here, and the first, this has been going on now for over a year. We hear this all year, any time of the year. So it's all year long. It's not in any one season. And it's always at night. That noise we hear is only at night.
Well, Cheryl, another option is for you to go and walk around in that area underneath those trees and see if you can find droppings. So turkeys have a very different dropping than what an owl is going to have for, like, whitewash. They have a dropping that kind of maintains its consistency more, like a mammal would. And so you could go and walk around in there and look up for, you know, whitewash, see what kind of trees it might be using as well, and see. And you might find an owl pellet as well. So
yeah, there you go.
Could be. Yeah, it's pretty wooded. It's pretty wooded, so it could be. You know, I just assumed it was the turkeys, and I yelled out the window one night at them, and I said, "All right, you guys, I gotta sleep. Go to sleep."
Well, Cheryl, you want to do a little more investigating, I think. I think Jamie might be right on this, and especially if you're hearing that song only a night, all year round. That is doesn't tell me it's turkeys.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Anyway, thank you again for calling. Paul in Oshkosh joins us next. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. This was about 10 years ago. I lived about a block off Lake Winnebago in Oshkosh. And one day, the sky was just about dark with what I thought looked like a barn swallow. It had the forked tail and dragonflies, which we would see dragonflies from time to time. But this one day, there were just hundreds, if not thousands, of these swallows up in the air with swarms of dragonflies feeding on them. And I was just wondering if that, is there like a hatching time for dragonflies, if that would have happened? Because I'd never seen that before, and I've never seen it since.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're sure it was barn swallows?
No, that's my guess.
Okay.
And again, that bird I had never seen in our neighborhood before, and all of a sudden there was hundreds of them up in the sky in this one day.
Do you remember what month it was? Was it late summer by any chance?
I think it probably was.
Yeah.
I want to say.
Well, so we've got a number of swallow species in the state. Barn swallow is certainly one of those species, and barn swallow is the only swallow species that has a truly forked tail. So it's hard to miss that bird. You know, and swallows are birds that eat on the wing, so they're insectivores. They eat a lot of insects and conceivably could eat dragonflies. But what I see a lot of times, the reason I ask late summer, what I see a lot of times in August, dragonflies are pretty abundant in the air, and you get common nighthawks that are migrating through going south, and they are just voracious eaters of dragonflies at that time of the year. And so I'm wondering if that's not what you saw as a common nighthawk. And those birds are maybe roughly the size of a crow, a little bit not as large, but in terms of body. They've got kind of a thin, longer wing. And one of the things that denotes them is sometimes hard to see, but on each wing they've got a white band or white stripe that goes from the top of the wing to the bottom of the wing, or the front of the wing to the back of the wing, however you want to look at that. And they, when they're migrating, they do migrate through in pretty large numbers in flocks, or they can do that. And I remember one time we saw, I think we counted 32 nighthawks over our yard one night just feasting on dragonflies. So look up common nighthawk and see if that wasn't the bird you saw.
Okay. Are they incredibly agile in the air?
Yes.
Like yes.
Yep.
Would be?
Yep. Yeah, so birds, just like bats that feed on insects, so it could be purple martins, it could be swallows, chimney swifts, nighthawks. All those birds have to be very agile, maneuverable flyers, because think about an insect and how maneuverable that insect is. So they've got to be able to catch that insect and be able to, you know, really make tight turns and be a very maneuverable bird in the air. And so all of those birds are. And if you look at their wing structure, that's what allows them to do that, is because those wings are very relatively triangular or long and thin, and it allows them to move very quickly through the air.
Sure. And you think it was likely, that would be my guess too, is a migration of birds. As like I said, I didn't see these normally
right
in my neighborhood, and then all of a sudden there's hundreds of them in one day.
Yep.
Yeah, that's undoubtedly what you were seeing.
Okay, well, perfect. Thanks for the information. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks
for the call.
Thanks for calling. Gene in Sussex, it's your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi, great show. I drive 41, 45 between Milwaukee and West Bend, and right by the Harley Davidson plant there, Menominee Falls. There's been a cormorant sitting on a telephone pole. You'd think it was a hawk but it's a cormorant. Is that kind of, doesn't seem like they should really be like around here, Horicon Marsh and that, but.
Yeah.
So, Gene, was there water in the area?
Yeah, there's a pond right there.
So I mean, when you look at that animal and that silhouette, mm-hmm. it's pretty hard to mistake it for anything else with the bill and the silhouette that it creates. Mm-hmm. Cormorants are found throughout the state. They certainly like to be around lakes or bays or even some of the larger rivers. They're feeding on fish and crustaceans. And when they nest in a rookery, so in a colony nesting situation, either on an island or in trees, like the great blue heron we mentioned earlier. So, I mean, they certainly can be solitary when it comes time for foraging and leaving the rookery area. And you know, I don't know what else to say. I mean, it certainly is possible. And
you
again,
find
if you've looked
much
at
everywhere,
it, yeah, yeah,
near
I mean,
water,
yep.
And they're migrating through right now,
right?
Too, so.
Yeah. So it might have just been resting and refueling in the area for a couple of days, and we'll move on.
Well, it was like 3 weeks or so
mm-hmm.
that it was sitting there. So it just seemed kind of strange.
Yeah, but it's hard to argue with that identification. So
for sure.
Yep.
Thanks, Gene. Appreciate the call. Keep your eyes peeled for more. Let's go to Ralph in Eau Claire next. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, sir. You touched briefly earlier in the show about turkey vultures, and I live in the Eau Claire area and have not hadn't seen any before the last year or two, and I just wondered, did I lead a protected life, or was there something that I missed? So,
yeah.
Information on turkey vultures.
I sure will. So turkey vultures are obviously a vulture species. They're a scavenging bird. They're relatively large amongst the birds that we have in the state of Wisconsin. So they're one of the larger birds. Typically all black, and they have a featherless head. And the reason they call it a turkey vulture is because they're a vulture, but their head looks like a turkey. And one of the reasons their head is featherless is because they scavenge and they jam that head into decomposing carcasses, and that's how they feed. And believe me, the food doesn't smell any better coming out the backside than it does going in the front side. So they are a relatively stinky bird in general. But you see them a lot of times up in the sky. They're a soaring bird. They can certainly flap their wings to fly, but they prefer to soar on the currents. The air currents are up in the air. And they kind of hold their wings in this what's called a dihedral V, and so they kind of rock back and forth as you see them up in the air. And if you look at them from below, that the entire length of the wing, half of it is white from the white feathers, and the other half is black, and that's a pretty distinctive way to look at them. I don't know about numbers of turkey vultures in the state of Wisconsin, but it wouldn't surprise me if their populations are increasing. And one of the reasons that I think that they are increasing over the, probably the last couple of decades, is we seem to have a lot more road-killed animals around in the landscape. And because they are a scavenging bird, there's plenty of food for them to eat. So they've been around for quite a while. Why you have or haven't seen them, maybe now they're starting to increase in your local area and they're just a little bit more obvious, or perhaps they've been there all along and it's kind of like learning.
Just didn't notice them.
Yeah, it's kind of like learning a new word. You learn that word, all of a sudden you see it all everywhere, and you're like, where'd that word come from? So it could be a combination of a couple factors.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Ralph.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Jane in Madison emailed to ask, when is the best time to clean out a birdhouse after the nesting season? She has a birdhouse that hosted a sparrow family this year, and a female is checking it out again. Would it be a good idea to clean it out? What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I don't know that female sparrow is checking it out as a nest site. She just might be exploring it or even using it as a roosting site from time to time. But typically with the nest boxes, it's a good idea to clean them out in the winter. Bluebird houses, we want to get those cleaned out. I usually say by early March, because the birds are one of the first to return. The concern is if you clean it out too early, you may end up with, let's say, a deer mouse or a white-footed mouse nest in there over the winter, and then it's not really available to a bird come spring. So if you want to clean it out because you want to see what happened and whether it was had a successful fledge or what species used the box, you could do that, but I would make another trip out there before March to clean it out again or potentially clean it out again. Others will leave their boxes kind of propped open for the winter and then close them up before that March 1st timeline.
Yeah, another good way to look at it. Tom in Green Bay thinks that bird we were talking about, that bird song, was a young great horned owl that's making that call that we were talking about, and I think that's a pretty good...
I think those are begging calls, you know, still kind of wanting to be fed.
Yeah, that could well be. Somebody else wondered if it wasn't peacocks.
I think we've got a better chance of being an owl than a peacock, so let's go with owl for the time being.
All right, well, we'll do that, and we'll take some more calls again, 1-800-642-1234. We have a lot of gardeners who listen to our show, and you have a message for them about encouraging messy gardening.
Yeah, this is kind of goes against my personality, but, you know, now's the time of year most of us are starting to kind of prepare the yard for winter, pulling things in, winterizing things, maybe a little bit, maybe in a couple weeks we've had some pretty warm weather, but our gardens are pretty much tapering down, and I'm talking about vegetable gardens, but also perennial gardens, and I want you to consider leaving some of that material on the landscape and explain why that would benefit wildlife. So, there's a couple of reasons, and this is actually a concerted effort by the Habitat Network, which is one of the citizen science programs out of Cornell Lab of Ornithology, so you can go there and learn more. But they are creating some awareness about leaving a messy garden as a pledge to be a lazy gardener and to help wildlife. So if you sign up to pledge, what they're asking you to do is to really leave your garden as is until spring and then clean it up. And so just real quickly, a few species that benefit from having that structure, that additional cover, are we've got a lot of certainly native bees and butterflies that either hibernate or will bury themselves, hibernate underneath that material, or create an underground burrow so that material on top, that leaf litter, branches, grass, and so on, will help insulate them. Butterflies, some of them will, some species of butterflies form a chrysalis, and they'll actually overwinter in maybe a curled up leaf that has fallen and is dry, or in a seed pod, and so leaving that on the landscape rather than raking it up and moving it somewhere else. And certainly for the birds, it gives them places to forage. Those seed heads, yeah, they're not putting out those pretty flowers anymore, but there's plenty of food within the heads or even dried fruits that you have in the garden. And then the other thing I think is a matter of us kind of changing our perception of that garden. You know, does it need to be bare ground, or is there beauty in having that structure and the different forms or colors? Even though there's shades of brown and yellow, they still provide, especially when the snow flies and you've got snow landing on that, or frost in the morning.
I think it's really pretty. I always leave mine up all winter. Yeah, and just a lot of winter interest there.
Yep, or you can collect some of the fallen leaves or twigs and kind of build a little brush pile. But some things that you can do are to leave the leaves on the property, so that gives some insulation to some of these animals we mentioned. And you could build the brush pile. And then, again, leaving snags is another big thing. So dead trees and even fallen logs, kind of leaving them. Think structure. So clean your house, that's fine, nice and tidy. But as far as the garden, if you're interested in wildlife and having more, then keep that structure available. And I think Jill has a link up on the website to the Cornell Habitat Network if you want to learn more about why to do it, how to do it, and then take that pledge.
Absolutely. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller as we talk the world of wildlife here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension, Jamie Nack and David Drake. Great to have them along. There's one open line at 800-642-1234 for your wildlife question. Maybe you've got a photo you want to share with us, a wildlife photo. We'd love to have you do that. Go to our Facebook page for that. And you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joe in Franklin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question's about robins. I mean, they show up here in May. They have their two broods. Then they disappear around the end of July. And now they're coming back. Where do they go in the meantime?
Well, they probably went up the street for a while.
Well, that's fine. I mean, do they head up north, like up to Canada someplace, and then, you know, work their way back down south?
No. So typically what they'll do is they'll come – well, let me back up a little bit. Robins are a migratory species, or can be a migratory species, but they can also be what's called an eruptive species. So depending on our winter and the severity of our winter – it's sometimes, if we have a mild winter, robins will be, especially down in the southern part of the state, they'll be here year-round, and they won't actually leave. And so that gives them a benefit. And when spring comes for mating season, they, if they're still here, they get the best breeding territory and get to set up earlier than everybody else. And so that gives them a boost for reproduction. So obviously we notice these birds when they're flocking together in the springtime and in the fall time when they're getting ready to migrate, if they are going to migrate. But in the summertime when they're nesting, you know, you might see them locally because they're tied to that local area where the nest is. And once the young fledge out of that nest and go on their own, then those birds can spread out a little bit more, and they're not necessarily tied to that local area. So they don't necessarily, if you've got a bird nesting in your yard, for example, after nesting season, they're not going to spend any more energy to go further north because it's not necessary for them to do that. But what they probably are doing is they're expanding their range a little bit because they're not so tied to that nest any longer. And so they're just spreading out a little bit further away from your yard. And that's probably one of the reasons you don't see them as often. But then you'll see them again in the fall because they're starting to flock up again, either to get ready for winter because they're gorging themselves to either prepare their body for winter if they're going to stick around here, or they're preparing their body to start migrating south.
Interesting.
Do red-winged blackbirds kind of do the same thing?
Yep, absolutely. So any bird that's migrating, you know, they'll migrate in flocks in the spring and the fall, and then they get up in breeding season or breeding territory, and when they're in that territory, you know, they're very territorial, and the male will exclude all other birds of that species from his territory except for the female that he's bred, and then they'll, raise a nest full of young, and then once that nest is done, they may re-nest again, but once nesting's over, then that territoriality kind of breaks down, and they'll start flocking up again near the end of the summer to fly south. And then you'll see kind of the opposite in the wintertime, birds that are staying here year-round, that they will flock up during the wintertime, or some species will, many species will, they'll flock up during the wintertime, and then they break out into single individuals again during breeding season when they get back on that territory.
Well, interesting.
All right.
And then that squawking noise at night, that's a young owl.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go to Facebook, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, for a minute here because Ben sent us a photo of a bird and wants to know, it looks like Ben's home is on a lake or close to right next to a lake, and on his deck perched a bird and was wondering what it is.
To me, it looks like one of the accipiter species, either a sharp-shin hawk or a Cooper's hawk. And based on the fact that it's perching on the railing of his back deck, Cooper's hawks and sharp-shin hawks are very typical species around residential areas because they eat other birds like robins and chickadees and things like that. And there's quite a few, prey bird species for that species. So it's hard. It's a profile. You get a see it from the side, but it does look like there's a little bit of banding on the tail there. It's hard to see the chest, and you would see some banding spottiness on the chest if you could see it head on. But it does
a cool picture.
It is, yes, kind of a neat picture. But I'm guessing it's one of the accipiter species, so Cooper's or sharp-shinned hawk.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me as well. Let's go to Paul in Somerset next. Hi, Paul.
How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
A year and a half ago, I had a buried thrush that stayed in my yard at the feeders all winter long. And I'm just wondering just how rare of an occurrence this is.
Well, David addressed this a little bit with the last caller, but it's not that unusual. It really depends on the winter severity that we're having, the snow, the cold temperatures, and their ability to find food. So we see even bluebirds stay the entire winter. So a bluebird is going to switch over from insects to feeding on dried fruits or native fruits that it can find. Same in the case of the thrushes. Robin's also a thrush. So if they no longer can get access because of frozen ground to some of the earthworms, then they're going to switch over to eating some of that fruit that's remaining on the trees into the winter.
Okay, but I've never seen a buried thrush before in my life. I've lived in Wisconsin all my life.
Well, I'll tell you one thing you could do, Paul, and we'll probably mention this again later in the show, but you could go into Wisconsin eBird, and that is a citizen science portal that allows you to record bird observations. And there's a way to explore that data by looking at, you know, you could look at your area through the whole year, through the previous 12 months, and look at that varied thrush as a species and see where the reportings have been in
the
state.
And you could report yourself as well.
And you could report yourself, yep.
Okay, I did let a bird group know about it, and they didn't seem to be overly impressed. So.
Well, that's usually a good indication. But yeah, like I said, those rarities like that, you can go and look and explore that data.
And thanks again for calling. Just back to Facebook for a minute, because there's a nice photo up here. What have we got here?
A canvasback duck.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's really pretty duck. So I was just looking at the Breeding Bird Atlas number 2. They just released some of the kind of preliminary results. They're about halfway through the Breeding Bird Atlas for the second go-round. And they've found 12 new species, and one of them was a canvasback. And I guess the canvasbacks were not confirmed breeding during the first Breeding Bird Atlas. So that's kind of neat that they're finding it during the second Breeding Bird Atlas. And it's a wonderful picture by David here. It's just a beautiful picture of that canvasback.
Yeah. With its young.
Yeah.
On its back. Almost. Isn't it?
I don't know if it's that.
I don't think so.
I think it's just the black back
right.
Tail feathers.
Oh, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just
the
perspective. It's a weird angle.
The wings are tucked back there over the back end.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is. But it's a really nice
photo. They're a regal bird. Yeah. Beautiful.
Really
awesome picture.
I've got a great wood carving of a canvas back. Let's go to Don and Loretta. Your turn, Don. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, great show. Thank you. Listen, I'm up here North Loretta, between Loretta and Clam Lake, and we've been coming up here for 47 years. And we five years ago or so, we still had evening grosbeaks by the dozens up here. And gray jays, or Canadian jays, whatever you call them. And now we don't see either one of them. I haven't seen either one for like 5-6 years. What's the deal?
Well, these are always interesting calls, because people will say, I haven't seen anything for a while. And there's a number of reasons for this, one of which is obviously the human species. We observe things in a whole bunch of different ways, and sometimes we see things that are right in front of our face. Sometimes we miss things that are right in front of our face. So I'm gonna throw out one of the possibilities is just a difference in your observational skills from year to year to year, or what you're noticing. So that's one possibility. The other issue is obviously these bird species move around. They're not necessarily tied to a specific area, but they're more tied to a resource. So if you've got, especially the grosbeaks, they're tied. They'll come to feeders that have slices of orange or grape jelly that's put out quite commonly. But they're a fruit-eating bird. So if you don't have available food in your yard, either because it's been a dry year and the fruit isn't being produced, or you're not putting something out at your feeder, you're not going to get grosbeaks. And so it could be a variety of reasons. It could be the fact that maybe the grosbeak population is down for whatever reason, and there just are not as many of them. So it's kind of hard to give a definitive answer, but there's probably a variety of reasons for something like that.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Don. Appreciate it. And Jim in Camp Douglas. Hi.
Hello, Larry. couple of things you can just elaborate on. A friend of mine snapped a photo of an albino robin in his lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a sight. The other night, I heard a whippoorwill for the first time in many years. And then I wanted to know, whatever happened to the bobwhite quail population that used to be fairly prevalent in the area here? And I'm in Midwest Wisconsin here, so I'll hang up and take your comments offline. Thank you.
All right. So we had whippoorwills, we had albino or bobwhite quail, and an albino robin.
Yep, all in 30 seconds, Jamie. Go.
Well, the bobwhite quail have certainly, their populations have been reduced, and a lot of that for them has to do with not as much edge habitats, pockets of habitat. We've lost a lot of CRP, or Conservation Reserve Program acreage, so their populations are declining. However, they are still here, and I'm assuming they've been picked up in the bird atlas.
And then we're going to take the other two right after we take a look at the news here, so keep listening, Jim. Our guests today, Jamie Nack and David Drake from the UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife with UW Extension and members of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, Jamie Nack and David Drake. Join in. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. We had a caller just before the newscast ask a few questions. One had to do with albino robin, the other with whippoorwills. He'd heard of a whippoorwill, which I haven't heard one for a long time.
Yeah, so I guess we'll start with the robin. So for an animal to be truly albino, not only does it have a white coat or white pelage, but it also has pink eyes, and if it's a mammal, it's got a pink nose. So typically for birds, the other variation is if they're not true albino for a mammal, we call them piebald. So they've got a white coat, but they don't have the pink eyes pink eyes and nose. For birds, we call it a leucistic variation of the coat. So that's a leucistic robin. It's got a white variation. There's something wrong mechanistically with the or structurally with the feather. Or more likely, there was some kind of a genetic mutation when the coloration of the feathers were getting laid down. So they're not common, because obviously you stand out, and for a predator, you're very easy to find and catch. In terms of the whippoorwills, those are a species that a lot of people, especially I think older people, recall fondly, because they call their name whippoorwill. Neat birds. And I think there's maybe some confusion in the state here, at least, about how solid is the population of whippoorwills. I think I've heard that they're not doing well because of loss of habitat, but I've also heard that they're doing okay, especially in pockets around the state. So I'm also confused about the status of whippoorwills as to whether their population status is good or not. But you do hear them. I mean, you go up north, you'll hear them. I was out at American Players Theater in Spring Green a couple years ago, and I heard them. That's what got me through the Shakespeare play that night. I heard them all throughout the play, and so I think it depends on really where you are.
Just to go back to Facebook for a minute, we were talking about nighthawks earlier, and we've got a great video from Dale, who has a video of nighthawks just flocking around and flying around. It's really a cool sight. So if you want to see what they look like when they're in the air, go to our Facebook page and take a look at it. It's on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So that's pretty cool. We have Hillary on Facebook wonders if there are spotted skunks in Wisconsin, and if so, when was the last time one was recorded?
Our first non-bird question of the day.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question, and I wish I was sitting at my office, because I'd pull a publication off the shelf to give you that specific information. But I would hazard to guess we have not had a spotted skunk confirmed sighting in decades. And so if you were to go to the Department of Natural Resources website and look for a publication called Terrestrial Vertebrate Checklist, there would be a footnote there for spotted skunks and talk about what the most recent confirmed sightings are, with some dates attached to them. One thing I'll mention, so we have not had any confirmed sightings in quite a while. I think this is a species that some of us sit back and are eager to see if Snapshot Wisconsin and that effort gives us evidence of spotted skunks in the next couple of years. So Snapshot Wisconsin is a camera trap study that the Wisconsin DNR, UW Extension, and a number of other entities are doing that is going to deploy trail cameras on private and public land as volunteers sign up to host a camera, with the idea of collecting photos and then being able to eventually have cameras in every county of the state, and then be able to download those photos, categorize those photos, and get ideas of relative population sizes, distribution of species. Like bobcat's another one that we would like to know more about in the southern part of the state. And this is one I've always thought, you know, if we're going to find a spotted skunk, this is how we're going to detect it, is through a trail camera. So it's been quite a while. Neat little animal, smaller than the striped skunk, and yeah, so that's
fun to see.
Yeah, fun to see.
Would be fun to see.
Would be. Yep.
John emailed to say that he says, don't be too sure that birds are not considering nesting activities. Not 20 minutes ago, I watched a female eastern bluebird collecting nesting material, straw, from my duck pen. She was very selective about the pieces she picked up and then flew to a nearby white oak cavity. She repeated this activity a half dozen times, and I managed to catch it on video. He thinks the weather has the birds confused.
Well, I don't know exactly what that bird is doing, but if it is trying to nest, it's doomed. It's young, because it is getting awfully late in the year to do that. And bluebirds are a migratory species. They're insect eaters, and obviously the food source isn't here in the winter, so they've got to leave our area. So I'm not exactly sure what that bird is doing, but it's probably unlikely that it's nesting. And typically what drives the nesting season, along with most other parts of an animal's life, be it migration, hibernation, whatever the case is, it's not necessarily the weather as much as it is the day length. And the day length is the primary driver of that. But obviously, right now we're having a little unusual weather, especially here in the southern part of the state, where it's a little bit warmer than usual, or it was. But usually day length, as the days start getting shorter, the animals realize, hey, it's time to start hibernating, or it's time to start going south if I'm a bird. And then along with the shortening day length, usually you get, colder temperatures and different weather patterns and things like that. And so those are some of the secondary drivers, but usually day length is really what's driving that more than the temperature.
And a couple more photos from visitor posts, one from Bev, who has a nice shot of a solitary sandpiper, really beautiful. And then going down here, Pat says, I wasn't able to find anything about these guys and their...
Looks like a gray tree frog.
You know, we had one of those this morning on our kitchen window, and I had commented to my wife, look at the size of that sucker. So, yeah, it's pretty neat. That's exactly what that is.
Richard in Huntsley, Illinois, has something for us. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Hi. This time of year, when the migration's coming through, bird strikes on the windows is fairly common. But I'm just going to send a little idea out to people. I get this material called garden scare tape, and it's a hologram type tape, about an inch wide. And I hang it from my windows, and it flitters in the wind. Very light wind makes it go, and I've actually reduced any hits almost completely now. So I just thought I'd pass it out. It's a real nice, simple way to protect your neighborhood friends. So.
And what's it called again?
It's called Garden Scare Tape.
Garden Scare Tape. Yeah, thanks for that, Richard. Jamie, a comment?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It is an important issue and cause for mortality for migrating birds. So, the reasons birds collide with windows are usually twofold. One, the window is set up in a way within the house that there's a window on each side of the home. So if it's your living room, you've got one wall with open windows and an open window on the other side. That birds coming through see that as a pass-through. They can see through one window, out the next window, and think that that's a clear area for them to fly. The other option is when there's reflection from vegetation in the window and they're not able to see that there's a barrier there. So you're doing exactly what we would encourage, which is to somehow break up that reflection. So in the first situation, if you can close the drapes and not create that fly-through situation, that can help. And then with the reflection, sometimes you can plant trees and shrubs that kind of block that window a little bit, break up that reflection. You can use the tape that you mentioned, Mylar tape, or even hanging a CD disc that moves in the sun, or a tin pie plate, things like that. You can also use some netting if it's pulled taut, but you need to be very careful with that because birds can get entangled in it as well. And when you start in the early construction of a home or a building, there's other things you can do at the construction or the building stages in terms of having tilted windows so that, again, you're minimizing the amount of reflection. So if you're interested in more on learning about window collisions and how to prevent them, again, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has a great website on how to prevent and reduce window collisions. So I'd encourage you to go there.
And I'll also point you to the American Bird Conservancy mm-hmm. as well. Yeah, both great resources.
Cindy posted on our Facebook page of her having a conversation, quote-unquote, with a barred owl in her yard a couple of years ago. So that's
love
a pretty...
all these videos.
Yeah, the videos are great, aren't they? We can't hear the sound right now, but I'm sure there's sound on it. David in Madison has something for us. Hi, David.
Hello. We had one pair of wrens come late in May. They were very quiet, and I wondered if there were other reports of wrens not being around as much this year.
I don't know. I know we had a wren nesting in the paper box beneath our mailbox this year, and that was the first time we've had that. So, you know, they're probably a little bit variable, but I would maybe suggest go to eBird Wisconsin if you have internet access, and you can find wrens, and you can get a sense about how many people are reporting wrens there, and that might give you a little bit of an idea about the abundance of wrens. But I've not heard anything about the wren population being down, and my sense is that they're actually
they're
doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Yvonne in Lake Geneva, your turn now. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening to the conversation on whippoorwills, and we rehabilitate birds and mammals, but we had the exciting experience of rehabilitating a chuckwill's widow from Sauk County.
Oh.
And we're able to get that one released, and also had newly hatched nighthawks from the La Crosse area this year.
Oh, wow.
Neat.
And, those are some of the most fun birds we get into care.
Yeah, that sounds great. And it's a good time to maybe plug rehabbers because
yeah.
people like Yvonne do some great work.
Yep, so this is a good opportunity to remind the public that when you're out and about and coming across wildlife, that never do you want to take the wildlife into your own care. So there are licensed wildlife rehabilitators throughout the state that have to meet certain requirements and go through a process to be licensed. So they have the expertise to care for wild animals, which you and I, me especially, yeah. do not. So it's pretty... specific. So if you ever need or find the need to come across and locate a wildlife rehabilitator by going to the DNR's website and typing in the keyword rehab, you'll come up to a website that has a PDF on it that you can click on and then search by county for a wildlife rehabilitator in your area. And they should be your first phone call when you come across a sick, injured, orphaned animal.
Yeah. Thank you again, Yvonne. Appreciate it very much. We had Roxanne in Trade Lake up next with a question. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, Larry. Not so much a question as an observation, and is it normal to have a squirrel crawl down the hummingbird feeder and drink out of the ports and take the bee guards off to do so?
Well, I don't know that that's terribly common, but that's a source of very high-energy food in that nectar feeder. You know, it's full of just sugar water, essentially. So that's what the squirrel's going after. And obviously, the squirrel's adaptable enough and smart enough to figure out how the heck to get access to it. So that's pretty interesting.
Conniving was the word that I used.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I was just really surprised. I didn't know they do that. So.
Yeah.
Watching the antics of squirrels can give you hours and hours of enjoyment.
Or frustration.
Or frustration.
Yeah, depending on your perspective.
And that hummingbird feeder is good that you still have it up. I see we had a Facebook comment from Susan in Chippewa County saying that she had hummingbirds there on Monday yet.
Yeah.
So.
And just because you haven't seen them for a week doesn't mean you're not going to have some migrants come through again, so definitely keep them up for a few weeks.
Yeah, thanks, Roxanne.
Okay. And do you think the monarchs are all gone now?
I have not seen a monarch in a while, and I know the tagging events are done down here, as far as I know. If there's more going on, let us know. But
I think it's pretty well
wrapped up.
Yep. There we go. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Kurt.
Morning, guys. About a week and a half ago, I put up a 12-apartment Purple Martin house about 16, 18 feet above ground. Within a day or two, the bluebirds are going crazy around it. Yesterday, there were at least three pairs that looked to be pairs fluttering around. One of them was actually hovering in front of the one of the apartments like a hummingbird would do. And I've seen them go in and not come out, at least not during the time that I stood there watching. So what's up? Bluebirds are not colonizers, as far as I know. So what's going on?
Oh.
That's a very good question. I'm a little perplexed by that as well. So you're right. They typically wouldn't nest in a colony. So whether they're just exploring it and maybe staking it out as a nest site this next spring and deciding who's going to get there first, but it might be they're just curious. It's something rather new in their environment that you've just erected, and they're going to check it out. I really can't offer much more than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got a better answer than Jamie, but the only other thing that just struck me is you say you just put the house up, but perhaps some kind of insects have occupied the house, and they're there for the insects they're feeding, and you just can't see the insects.
That's possible.
Yeah.
It's and to kind of go along with the bluebird topic here, Todd in Delavan emailed to tell us he had three bluebirds over winter the past 3 to 4 years. Wondered what they were eating.
Yeah, so they'll switch over to fruit primarily. And then open water will be really important for them too. So a lot of times folks will have a heated bird bath, and we'll see some beautiful pictures with snow on the edges of that heated bird bath and bluebirds there. But yeah, they'll switch over from insects to remaining fruit that they can find.
And sometimes if you're, especially if you are a fly fisher, that if you ever go out in the wintertime, you do see insect hatches off the water on a, bright, warmer, sunny day. And so, if you have open water in particular. So there are insects around. They're just not as abundant or plentiful as they are in the spring and summer.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Kurt. Roxanne in Clark County, your turn. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi. Someone just asked about monarchs, and we had we rent out a field, part of our property, and it has flowering radishes in it right now. It's a winter cover crop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And last week there were thousands and thousands of monarchs feeding on these radishes.
Huh. Yeah.
Very
great.
Cool.
Well, thanks for sharing that. They apparently are still here and still working their way south.
Yeah, they're on different days. I think it was last Monday, they were the majority of them, and they were like hanging in the pine trees. They had roosted overnight, and then several days later, we were seeing them along with many, many, many other pollinators. But the monarchs were just amazing.
I think is it Monarch Watch? Is that the citizen science portal that people can report monarchs? And so maybe if Google Monarch Watch, those of you interested in monarchs, and see if there's some information there about the migration and where that they are in their stage of migration.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, Roxanne.
Sure. Okay,
yeah.
Bye.
I appreciate the call. We had Jim on Facebook say he's had a lot more black squirrels this year. He's in the central Wisconsin area, wondering about black squirrels. Jamie?
Well, black squirrels are still the same species as a gray squirrel. They are a gray squirrel. but they have a different pelage color. So there are other species that have different color phases. Actually, this is really the opposite of being an albino animal. They're melanistic, so they have too much pigment in their makeup, and that produces that black pelage to them. But they're still a gray squirrel in terms of their species. And as David alluded to earlier, this is likely a genetic mutation, result, yeah. What tends to happen then with what we see with black squirrels is they tend to be in certain areas where you see a higher concentration of black squirrels as they're reproducing. And I suppose they're not quite as vulnerable as an albino animal on the landscape, so they have occur more frequently on the landscape. But yeah, we'll often get calls, Boulder Junction. I'm trying to think of some of the areas we often hear, people reporting a high number of black squirrels. But that's what it is, just a melanistic gray squirrel.
Jill says we're getting lots of reports. She's getting lots of phone calls of people seeing monarchs from all over Wisconsin. So they're still here.
That goes to show I'm not an entomologist.
Gil emailed to ask for a recommendation for an illustrated book with only Wisconsin birds.
I don't know about it. I'm not familiar with an illustrated book, but the pictorial book or the book full of photos is by Stan Tequila. It's T-E-K-E-I-L-A, I believe is how you spell his last name, but it's a book that has only Wisconsin birds. And then obviously you can find a book on Eastern United States birds, and then primarily that will be birds that are found mostly in Wisconsin as well as other parts. But if you want a Wisconsin-specific book, the only one I'm aware of is Stan Tequila's book. Yeah,
I think that's – and it's called Birds of Wisconsin.
I think so, yeah. I don't know, Jamie, do you know of any other books?
That's the, as far as the field guide, I think the historical is robins.
Yeah. The other one is they do have the Wisconsin
right.
Bird Atlas would be the other one. But that's a pretty big book. It's not something you can put in your back pocket as you're
data
out
rich.
Of the field.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I tell you what, here we have the great season of the year as far as I'm concerned. Fall, great time to get out. For finding programs and events, DNR's got some good website.
Yeah, there is so much going on at this time of the year. I was just looking, always trying to find things to do on the weekends with a young family. And from fall festivals, there's a lot of candlelight hikes that go on at this time of the year at various state parks that can get you out, trail runs, a lot of educational programs, and a whole lot more. And if you were to go to the DNR website and just type in the search words, get outdoors. So get outdoors, and you can then search the event calendar by local area. You can search it by the date. So if you've got Saturday open, you can type in Saturday's date, and it'll give you a list of the events that are primarily in state parks throughout the area. And just as an example, Horicon Marsh is having an archaeological festival October 14th and 15th, so in a week and a half. That's going to include free admission. They'll have historical educational events as well. So that would be an example to check out.
Yeah, lots of good things there. Boy, great show today. Thank you both very much for coming by. And you're back on December 6th.
Yep.
That'll be a lot of fun as well. Jamie Knack, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. David Drake, a professor in that department and also with UW Extension. Great to have them, and they'll be back on December 6th. In November, the first Wednesday of the month, Scott Craven will join us. Tomorrow at this time, Mike Riley will be back to talk about insurance and what to do if you're injured. So I hope you'll tune in for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Please stay with us. What's in store on the Ideas Network?